Om, salutation to the Buddha. I bow down in adoration to the Buddhas and their sons, and to the body of the Dharma, and to all those who are praiseworthy. I will describe briefly, according to the scriptures, the way the sons of the Buddha enter the spiritual life. There is nothing really original here, and I have no skill in literary composition. I do not imagine I can benefit others. I have done this to perfume my own mind. While doing this, the surge of my inspiration to cultivate the good increases. If, later on, this work is seen by another person, someone like me, then they too might benefit. So these are the first three verses of Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara, which we can translate as entering the path of enlightenment, or the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. And it's a Sanskrit work composed in the 8th century in India, and it's been extraordinarily influential in India and especially in Tibet. There have been many, many commentaries made on the Bodhicharyavatara over the centuries. It's been a source of incredible inspiration and instruction to many generations of Buddhists. And that tradition has actually carried on into the West. There are many, many translations into modern languages of the Bodhicharyavatara, and many of those are in English, but in many other modern languages. And it's important in our own Buddhist movement as well. It was the first seminar that Sangharakshita, the founder of our order, ever did. He started to do a whole series of seminars with order members and mitras and friends beginning in the 70s. And the first of these was on the Bodhicharyavatara. And it's regularly studied. It's been regularly studied since something like 1989 on the four-month men's ordination course at Guhyaloka. It's studied after the men are ordained, and it's seen, it's regarded really as a sort of manual for what it means to be an order member. That's the way it needs to be approached. And it's widely read in our movement. You can find, if you click onto Free Buddhist Audio, loads and loads of different talks on different themes from the Bodhicharyavatara. And the text has also given us one of our basic practices, that is the Sevenfold Puja. It's our fundamental devotional practice, and it's regularly practiced throughout our community, practiced in different languages all over the world. So the question is, why is this text so very important? Well, it's important because it describes the practices of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is the individual being, sattva can be translated as being, who is committed to, vowed to, attaining enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. So a Bodhisattva is someone who is committed not just to their own spiritual growth, their own spiritual transformation. They are just as committed to the spiritual growth, the spiritual transformation, the uplift of all others. So the Bodhisattva is one who practices the Dharma in order to be a force for good in the world. Put more radically, the Bodhisattva is someone who has realized to a decisive extent that there can be no such thing as happiness, well-being, satisfaction, meaning, spiritual fulfillment, even enlightenment, just for oneself alone. That's impossible. Enlightenment for oneself alone is simply impossible. It's impossible because love and compassion are intrinsic to enlightenment. This means that if one's spiritual life is not manifesting in love for others, actually expressed in deeds to benefit others, then it's not really the spiritual life. It's not really the Buddhist life at all. It's something else, a fantasy of spiritual life. So Shantideva's text describes what we need to do to follow the path to enlightenment for the benefit of all. And Shantideva describes a very demanding path indeed. I know when we get to study this text on the four-month ordination course, the order members, they really struggle, you know, sometimes. They really just get fed up with Shantideva going on and on and on about being altruistic and all the rest of it. Some people love it and they get very inspired, but it really is relentless and demanding. You could describe the text, you could characterise the text as a training. It's offering a training in radical selflessness. There's three aspects to this selflessness. There's what you might call existential selflessness, selfless behaviour, selfless deeds. You might call that as well, you know, moral selflessness. Secondly, there's contemplative selflessness, developing a genuinely selfless mind through the practice of meditation and reflection. And thirdly, metaphysical selflessness. This comes about through wisdom, through insight, seeing that in reality, in fact, we do not possess a fixed and abiding, permanent and separate self at all. The aim of all this, all these practices and trainings, is spontaneous, compassionate activity, the Bodhisattva's lila, the Bodhisattva's endless creativity. That's the aim of this text. So when we talk about selflessness, that can make us feel perhaps a little uneasy. Does that mean disparaging ourselves, beating ourselves up? Is it a new kind of brand of self-hatred and so on? But it's actually true. Sometimes Shantideva can be extraordinarily self-critical. It's one of the most almost savage texts when you read it. Sometimes he really lays bare his own failings to practice the Bodhisattva's life in a way that can really make you gulp. It can sometimes seem a bit too much. Although it has to be said, sometimes we do need to do that. We need to have that kind of self-honesty if we're to make any real spiritual progress. But Shantideva doesn't just do that. He's very, very skillful. He frequently uses very subtle argument to tease us out of our self-interest, which of course, you know, we all have. He acknowledges, in fact, our self-interest very, very often. He often seems to say, well, actually, it's in your own self-interest, your own healthy self-interest, to think, to act altruistically, to think and act for the benefit of others. If you do that, that will enrich you. He sometimes uses these sorts of arguments. And you know, I think we can sometimes see that in our own experience. We might be feeling really sort of miserable, and then somebody says, look, can you give me a hand just to move this thing or chop this veg or whatever it might be? And suddenly we feel differently just through doing that. We even notice something of this kind of attitude in the opening verses that I've read out. Shantideva says, first of all, that he's not writing anything original, anything new. He's writing his book really for his own benefit, which is interesting, given that it's a book of instruction. He's writing the book, he says, this beautiful phrase, to perfume his own mind. In writing about the way in which a bodhisattva lives, he wants his mind to be perfumed and influenced by the bodhisattva's life itself. Shantideva's writing, then, is not an academic exercise. His writing is, in fact, a spiritual practice in itself. As he writes, he's perfuming himself with the sweet perfume of the bodhisattva's life, the bodhisattva's training. More than that, as he writes, he says he experiences, as the verse has it, a surge of inspiration towards the good, the skillful, the wholesome. So the Bodhicharya Avatara of Shantideva is an inspired text. There are passages where you seem to really feel that surge of inspiration coming off the page, even sometimes in rather stilted English translations. It's got that flavour of inspiration. In fact, Shantideva seems to be someone who is writing from a profound spiritual experience. He seems to be writing, perhaps he's writing, from what is known as the arising of the bodhicitta, bodhicittapada, the arising in one of the force of wisdom and compassion, the force that impels one to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all, the force that makes you a bodhisattva. And I'll be saying more about the bodhicitta as we go on throughout this these whole 2 weeks. But although Shantideva is writing to benefit himself, to perfume his mind, he hopes that others will benefit from reading his texts. His text. He wants his own exploration of the Buddha's teaching, his own clarification of the Buddha's teaching, to benefit both himself and others. And, you know, we can experience something similar, perhaps, on our own level, but as it were from the other direction, so to speak. Sometimes non-Buddhist friends will ask us, or, you know, maybe even friends who, you know, were asking you why you were going on a retreat this winter, rather than doing the usual Christmas things. And you tell them, you start explaining to them what it means to you to practice Buddhism, to practice meditation, and explaining that, you find that you become clearer yourself about the Dharma. They benefit from how you explain it to them. They find out more about why you practice, what Buddhism is. You benefit from doing the explaining. It becomes clearer to you. So there's benefit for self and other. So altruism isn't self-abnegation. We benefit from altruistic activity. And Shantideva, you notice in his verses, is genuinely humble. He begins in the traditional Buddhist way of adoring and bowing to the Buddhas, the enlightened ones, and to the body, the collection of the Dharma texts, the teachings, the Buddha's teachings. He adores and bows down to the bodhisattvas, the great bodhisattvas like Manjushri and Vajrapani and so on. Avalokiteshvara, who he describes as the sons of the Buddha, the spiritual sons of the Buddha. He bows down to everybody who is worthy of praise. He worships, which means he's opening up to the embodiments of his overarching spiritual ideals. He insists as well that he's not going to be saying anything original, which is such a refreshing statement in this age, which is always hungry for novelty, which is not really originality at all, of course. It's so refreshing to read someone who's not interested in being original. He wants instead to write something which is faithful to his tradition, expressive of the spiritual ideals that he adores, that have been there for ages. And it's interesting, having said that, though, because the Bodhicaryavatara is genuinely original. There's nothing quite like this text in the Buddhist tradition. Although it's steeped in the Buddhist tradition with so many references to Buddhist texts that have gone before it, the Bodhicaryavatara has its own particular flavour and genius. It's certainly not a dry, formulaic presentation of pre-existing material. There's some vital force and energy that seems to pervade the text. And perhaps we can enrich our appreciation of this through looking at the life of Shantideva himself, the traditional life. It's almost a sort of mythical life, but it does have even so a significance. Actually, in a strict Western historical sense, very little is known about Shantideva. Tradition tells us that he was born sometime in the 8th century into a royal family in Western India, somewhere in what is now known as Gujarat state. This was such a in modern India, it's quite interesting. When I was living in India in the 80s, I discovered a postage stamp with Shantideva on it. You know, because he was Indian, because he was from Gujarat, there was the Indian Postal Service issued a Shantideva stamp. I don't think I've got that anymore, but I was quite pleased by that. Shantideva postage stamp. Anyway, he left home, left Gujarat at a young age, and he ended up at the huge monastic university, which is more like a great city in North India, known as Nalanda, this huge place. And he was ordained as a bhikshu, a Buddhist monk. But to others, he seemed a very lazy monk, because he seemed to spend his days eating, sleeping, and going to the toilet. So they nicknamed him Busuku, which means, apparently, eats, sleeps, shits. Busuku, apparently. And he was the butt of a lot of ridicule from the other monks. His actual ordained name was Shantideva, God of Peace. But no, he was eat, sleep, shits. And the monks were obviously quite fed up with him. You know what these communities can be like. Well, perhaps you don't. But anyway. But they wanted to humiliate him even further. And they wanted that humiliation to be very public. At Nalanda, it was the custom to hold regular, weekly, public Dharma teachings with all the monks present, all the lay people, as well as the local king and dignitaries, the nobility. And these public Dharma teachings were extremely important because the king and the other nobles were, of course, the patrons of the monastery, and the monastery was dependent on their patronage. So the monastic community decided that Busuku, Shantideva, should deliver a discourse on the Dharma. The monks were sure that Busuku would look an absolute fool in front of the king, so much so that he could be safely expelled from the monastery. And the tradition was at Nalanda that a discourse could either be a commentary on existing Buddhist texts, or it could be a new composition, a new text, which of course would all be given orally. It would only be written down later, so the composition would be something that was in the monk's mind. So Shantideva was told to ascend to the teaching throne, and he said he would be reciting a new text, which of course the monks found very amusing, and we can imagine them smirking and giggling among themselves. He's going to make such a fool of himself. See, not all of these ancient Buddhist monks were saints by any means. And then Shantideva began to recite, beginning with the verses I read at the beginning. And on he went, reciting clear, beautiful, subtle, deep, incisive Dharma words. And of course, the monks very quickly stopped smirking and laughing. They were just amazed and just had to sit there soaking up the Dharma teaching. They were even more amazed because as he spoke, as it went on, the surge of inspiration raised Shantideva into the air and higher into space. You can see this on our painting, the way Alok has done it. He's taking off from the Dharma throne. And eventually he disappeared into space, and there was just his voice sounding the Dharma from space. Absolutely wonderful image. And the voice eventually faded away, and Shantideva was never seen at Nalanda ever again. But the old stories, the old traditions tell us that what happened to him was that he became one of the wandering Mahasiddhas, the wandering, greatly accomplished ones. He lived in the forest, the great jungle, with the very poor, the so-called outcast people, the tribal peoples, people completely ostracized by conventional Indian society. And he just travelled around, tending them, taking the Dharma to the most neglected, to the most excluded, living the Bodhisattva life for the benefit of all. What the monks at Nalanda didn't know was that Shantideva did all his study and spiritual practice at night in his monastic cell. At night, when all was quiet, when there were no distractions and no busyness. These big monasteries apparently could be extraordinarily busy. He would be studying and practicing all night long in the silence. He was not only practicing and studying, he communed with his spiritual friend, his Kalyana Mitra, who was none other than Manjugosha, the sweet voiced, Manjushri, the gentle glory. There's an icon of Manjugosha there. Every night Manjugosha would come and talk to him, teach him the archetypal bodhisattva of wisdom. And he would teach him personally, away from the noise and competition of a busy monastic university. There are passages, in fact, in the Bodhicharyavatara where Shantideva refers to that competitive and busy atmosphere and the need to get away to seriously practice, to get away from theory and debate, because theory and debate were big features of these Indian monasteries at their height, to get away from all that to really live the spiritual life. And there's a real urgency throughout the Bodhicharyavatara, a real urgency and really urging people to practice very, very seriously. And the very next verses make clear what our actual situation really is and why there needs to be urgency. This favourable moment, so hard to find, has arrived. Once found, it should be directed to the goal of man's life. If this opportunity is not taken now, when will it come again? At night, in darkness thick with clouds, a flash of lightning gives a moment's brightness. So sometimes, by the grace of the Buddha, the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of good. The brightness is hard to obtain constantly, while the forces of evil are very terrible. What other good could threaten those forces but the perfect bodhicitta? So by the favourable moment, so hard to obtain, Shantideva means being born as a human being. The favourable moment is this precious human life, this precious human existence. Shantideva, Buddhist tradition generally, regards being born as a human being as a very, very, very great blessing. We are extremely fortunate and blessed to have this human life. The human life is regarded as being as precious as a special jewel, a jewel that can grant all wishes. We contend, if we're not careful, to concentrate on the problems and difficulties of being human. There are so many problems and difficulties, individual and collective problems and shortcomings. We know them only too well, and we can begin to even think that human life is intrinsically flawed and problematic. Better be done with it, abolish it or something. But Buddhist tradition says, no, human life is precious and very, very special. So first of all, we need to just wake up to the sheer pleasure and wonder of being alive right now. Just forget problems and troubles and complexes. Forget any sense of lack and notice the pleasure and wonder of being alive and being aware. Sometimes people have difficulty in the metta bhavana, especially in the first stage of the metta bhavana, developing loving kindness for ourselves. But they very often overlook their basic experience of being aware. What a wonderful thing it is to be able to breathe, to be able to see and to smell and to touch and to taste and to hear. To be able to hear the sounds of birdsong, even to hear a car passing past. To be able to kind of just be in silence, be aware of silence. There is so much we overlook in our basic human experience where there is so much wealth and richness. And of course, we live in a, a world nowadays where we're encouraged to feel lack, that we should go and get more and more and more. But there's so much wealth and richness in basic human experience. But that's only the beginning of a reflection on this precious human life. Shantideva says, once this favourable moment has been found, it should be directed to the goal of man's life. The word for goal in Sanskrit is artha, which can also mean good and meaning. For Shantideva, the goal, the meaning, the good in a man's life is nothing less than attaining enlightenment, becoming a Buddha. Life needs to be directed towards growing in the direction of Buddhahood. That's what life is for. That is the meaning and purpose of human life. Human life is special and precious because human beings have an affinity with the goal of Buddhahood, with enlightenment, with the state of a Buddha. Although that is the most profound and lofty ideal, it is in fact a natural ideal for us as human beings. It's where the evolutionary urge is tending, if you like. There is something in us that resonates with enlightenment, with Buddhahood. Enlightenment is described as having two great aspects which are completely conjoined. There is wisdom, seeing things as they really are, seeing life as it really is, stripped of all the veils of ignorance and confusion. And perfectly fused with such seeing is the other great quality, compassion. The loving response, the active loving response to the suffering of others. Not just their physical suffering and their psychological suffering, but their deep existential suffering. The suffering of not being enlightened. The suffering of unknowing. The suffering that comes through dwelling in the darkness of ignorance. A Buddha is one who has attained such wisdom and compassion. That's his natural state. And human beings have an affinity with that state. The Buddha, after all, is a human being. He's not a god, but he's a man. In a sense, like us, in a sense, beyond us because of his spiritual attainment. But nonetheless, we have something of wisdom and compassion in us as human beings. We possess, for a start, awareness. Awareness is the seed of wisdom. We don't just have awareness through our senses. We can reflect on the meaning of our experience, on the significance of our experience. So we possess a quality of knowing and seeing things as they are. It's already here. And we also have friendliness, kindness, and generosity. We have fellow feeling, at least to some people, some of the time. So our awareness and our kindness, they might not be fully fledged wisdom and compassion, but they might be intermittent and mixed up with and broken up by confusion and selfishness. Maybe long periods of those, but the fact is, because we possess awareness and friendliness, we have the potential to gain enlightenment. And that's what we need to build on. We need to identify those qualities in ourselves and deepen them and take them so that they grow to full-fledged wisdom and compassion. That is what life is for. That is the goal of man's life, to grow and develop in and for wisdom and compassion. We might be involved in many, many other things, interesting and meaningful things, but in the end, how meaningful are they without them being the expression of awareness and love? We need to ask ourselves that. Now, this affinity we have with enlightenment is described very beautifully, very tenderly actually, in another text of Shantideva's called the Shiksha Samuchaya, or the Compendium of Training. In this text, Shantideva quotes from a Buddhist text, from a sutra, in which the Buddha speaks to Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, describing what the affinity with enlightenment is like. The Buddha says, "Truly, O Manjushri, a tiny sparrow, cast forth from the egg membrane, without the shell fully broken, and without as yet having stepped forth from the egg, utters just a sparrow's cry. Even so, Manjushri, a potential bodhisattva, wrapped in the membrane of ignorance, utters the cry of a Buddha, the cry of emptiness, unconditioned and unfettered. So there's something in us that longs for fulfillment, longs for enlightenment. It might be a very small voice, the cry, the cheep cheep of a baby sparrow, but it can break through, it can break out all the way to enlightenment. And this precious human life is not given to us for very long. Shantideva describes it as a favourable moment. Just a favourable moment. We have this life for a very short time. A man's life is not really very long in the general scheme of things. It's not long, given what life is really for. We're not given this life for very long. Given that we need to be transforming ourselves into a Buddha, that we don't have a lot of time in which to do that. There is also the fact that this life is very uncertain. We can so easily assume, we do easily assume, we don't even think it, we just assume it, that we will go on living to a ripe old age. You know, we even picture our deathbed scenes where we're surrounded by friends and we're giving our final words and so on. But the fact is, death can come at any moment. We don't know when it will come. Each day, each moment could be our last. And this is something that Shantideva was keenly aware of. And throughout his Bodhicharavatara, he contemplates death and the impermanence, the momentariness of life, especially in the second chapter where he's looking at his failings. Everything experienced fades to memory. Everything is like an image in a dream. It is gone and not seen again. Night and day, my life advances to destruction. Nothing can stop it. I must surely die. And he contrasts the uncertainty and suddenness of death with a life led simply following likes and dislikes, craving and aversion. This death is indifferent to what has been done or not done. Like a thunderbolt, he strikes me down in health as well as sickness. For the sake of my likes and dislikes, I have done many kinds of wrong. I did not remember that sooner or later, I must depart this life, abandoning all and alone. What I hate will cease to be. What I love will cease to be. I will cease to be. And all will cease to be. And Shantideva's final words here are not a brand of nihilism. He's meditating on the fact that living a life pulled and pushed by likes and dislikes, perhaps even doing things to be liked, doing things to avoid being disliked, even so-called meaningful things, in other words, a life ruled by craving and aversion, is such a waste. Because in the end, all that will cease. All those things that we like and dislike will cease. It will all vanish. It will all be taken. So what have we done? What are we living for right now? So Shantideva's urging us not to not waste time, but to treasure what we have. Something has opened up in our lives, and Shantideva describes this very beautifully and feelingfully. At night, in darkness thick with clouds, a flash of lightning gives a moment's brightness. So sometimes, by the grace of the Buddha, the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of good. So in this precious human life, there are moments when the thick dark night of ignorance, of unawareness, is just lit up by a bright lightning flash. For a moment, everything is clear. We see that we don't have to stumble along, or that we see that we don't have to follow the same old tracts laid down for us by custom, circumstance, and our old tired habits. For a moment, the whole landscape is illumined. We see it laid out, beautiful, glorious. We glimpse, we intuit a completely new life, an open life. We glimpse the path to Buddhahood. And Shantideva says that this comes through the grace of the Buddha. Buddhanubhava is the Sanskrit word. Anubhava means something like blessing, influence, or even the power of the Buddha. And sometimes that is the only way to describe these experiences where life is lit up, where it's illumined. It's as if sometimes a different dimension has been opened up to us, seemingly out of the blue, a vision, an ecstasy, an inspiration. Sometimes that moment of clarity won't be quite so dramatic. It'd be more like a quiet intuition that we know that there is a different way to live. However we describe it, however we experience it, there are moments when the fabric of life is broken and the light, the brightness, shines through. So it's important that we take these precious moments seriously, these moments of vision, these moments of the awakening of faith, these moments of illumination. We need to make these moments the centre of our life. We need to build on them and act on them. It's so sad to meet people who have had such moments, such periods in their life, but who, for one reason or another, neglect them. They don't take them seriously. They've allowed them to be overrun by the thick black clouds, by life, by the busyness of life. Things that at the time seem so much more important, but which in the end are actually really very superficial compared with that brightness that was seen. You meet them sometimes, older, tired, regretting what the vision they had, regretting, neglecting the vision that they had, sometimes brooding over their past hurts, that brooding over, you know, their life, but actually it's to do with their own neglect of what's important. The Buddha describes such people in the Dhammapada very, very vividly. And when I say older, I mean older of all ages, by the way. Those who have not led the spiritual life or obtained the wealth of merit in their youth, such as these brood over the past like aged herons in a pond without fish. Those who have not led the spiritual life or obtained the wealth of merit in their youth, such as these lie like worn out arrows, lamenting the things of old. Incredible images, really vivid. These are the words of the Buddha. Aged herons, just looking around in an empty fish pond, and worn out, spent arrows. I think the latter suggests that, you know, that arrows, they kind of communicate the sort of real purpose and aim of life. You know, there is a purpose and aim to life, like an arrow speeding towards a target. That's what our life should be. We shouldn't end up sort of just like spent arrows. So we don't need to be like aged herons or worn out arrows. We can seize our vision. We can live from the vision and make the most of the good conditions we have to lead a spiritual life. Because we don't only possess a precious human body, we live at a time when the Buddha lived. Long ago for sure, but the Buddha is still a living example and his teaching is alive. There's a clear path and there are clear and effective practices available to us. There are spiritual friends who can teach us and inspire us and support us. There are places to go that have been set up to support our spiritual practice, and we have the freedom, we actually have the leisure and the time to practice. I know sometimes people feel they don't have enough leisure, but compared with some parts of the world, we have enormous leisure to go away for a week or 2 weeks in the middle of winter to practice the Dharma. That means we've got fantastic leisure. We need all these good conditions to support us, and they're available to us. We don't have to let custom, circumstance, habit, we don't have to let the world overwhelm us. We can push it back so that the brightness may shine. We need to keep doing that if we are to discover life's true meaning. So we need two things in order to discover life's true meaning. Firstly, we need to make constant individual effort to practice and to grow along the path. And secondly, we need to make the most of the good conditions that we have available to us, especially in the form of spiritual friends and spiritual community, until the indestructible, transcendent dimension opens up, the bodhicitta, the mind, the heart of enlightenment itself, the force of wisdom and compassion. As Shantideva puts it, the brightness is hard to obtain constantly, while the forces of evil are very terrible. What other good could threaten such forces except by that which is called the perfect bodhicitta? So tomorrow we'll look at the bodhicitta and maybe we'll see how it can defeat and threaten the forces of evil.